Now, we were speaking at our last meeting together about the world into which Christianity came. That was Roman numeral 1. Under that capital C was Judaism. And under that, I had just spoken, I believe, about the event around 132 A.D. when Bar Kokhba led an insurrection, a group of Jews who seized Jerusalem and tried to gain their independence from the Romans. This was a comparatively small number out of the total number of Jews who by this time were widely scattered throughout the empire. And this small group thought that Bar Kokhba was going to fulfill the prophecies of the book of Numbers about the son of a star who would overcome Edom, which they took to mean Rome then. But the Romans completely overcame him after a number of battles. Eventually, he was defeated, and he and all his forces were killed. And then Jerusalem was made into a heathen city, and all Jews were forbidden to come within several miles of Jerusalem under pain of death. And so you have a gap there of a number of years, of some centuries, in which there were no Jews at all in Jerusalem. The Jews then, by this time, were quite distinct from the Christians. At the very beginning, as you know, the Christianity was considered as simply a sect of the Jews. And the Roman government considered it as simply a little group of Jews differing some ways from the others, and they didn't want to interfere among them. But by this time, there were comparatively few Jews becoming Christians. I believe in every generation from the time of Christ to the present, there have been Jews who have become Christians in every generation. And some of them have been among the finest ornaments of the Christian church through the ages. But the greatest influx of Jews into Christianity came during the immediate time after the crucifixion of Christ, during the next few years. And it gradually decreased and decreased, giving Paul that great problem which he faced in Romans 9 and following, where he said he wished he might be accursed for his people, the people of Israel, if that they would come and to know the truth of God and to be saved through Christ. And so in our church history, after 100 A.D. at least, the Jews are not an important factor in the history of Christianity. They are an extremely important factor, as you know, of course, in the book of Acts. It was from them that the greater number of early Christians came. There were many Pharisees, Acts tells us, who became Christians. Many of the priests became Christians. And it was also from the Jews that the first persecution came. And at first, the Roman Empire was a protector of the Christians against groups of Jews and heathen stirred up by groups of Jews against the Christians. Now we go on then to Roman numeral 2. Roman numeral 2 is the church in the first century. And under this, capital A will be the political background. Now, we will not have to take much time now on the political background of the church in the first century because of the fact that we have already, in our examination of the church into which Christianity came, surveyed the general political situation in the first century. But I think it would be helpful for you to have, at least in your notes, the specific names of the emperor who reigned in the first century. And we will say just a word or two about them. The first of these was the Emperor Augustus. Augustus was the first of the Roman emperors. Julius Caesar had established the control that led to the foundation of the Roman Empire, but before he could consolidate it, he was assassinated in 44 B.C. And his great nephew, Octavius, after he established himself supreme in the Roman Empire, took the name of Augustus, and he's usually referred to as the Emperor Augustus. He was emperor from 30 B.C. to 14 A.D. So you see, he was the emperor who gave the order that all the world should be taxed, and that all should go to their ancestral homes in order to have the census taken. And therefore, he has a direct relationship to Christianity in that it was his order which led to Christ being born in Bethlehem. Augustus died in A.D. 14. And of course, at that time, Jesus was not over 19 years of age. So Christianity as a separate religion could not be said to have been started yet while Augustus was emperor. He was succeeded by his great nephew, whom he had adopted, whose name was Tiberius. And Tiberius was emperor from 14 to 37. So you see, he was the one who was ruling in the Roman Empire when Christ was crucified. He was the emperor to whom Pontius Pilate reported, and who had appointed Pontius Pilate as in control over the region of Judea. Tiberius ruled, as you see, for 23 years, and he carried on the tradition of good administration throughout the empire as a whole. Augustus had established it on a very fine foundation of government according to law, maintaining the tradition of the Roman Republic that preceded, but putting an end to the squabbles at the top that had previously threatened to bring anarchy. Tiberius carried on the tradition of Augustus, except that in his later years he became rather embittered, and there were some rather disagreeable things, which, however, did not affect the empire as a whole much, were mostly simply at Rome and the area round about it. But Tiberius adopted a relative, a young fellow, who became emperor, succeeding him in 37. And this young man had worn little boots as a boy, and people had nicknamed him after these little boots. And so they called him Caligula, Latin for little boots. And he's known in history as the Emperor Caligula. He's known by this nickname rather than by his actual name. Caligula only reigned for 4 years, 37 to 41. But Caligula is of interest to us in connection with Bible study because of the fact that some think that certain statements in the Bible refer to him or relate to some of his activities. Caligula inherited an empire well organized, a government well established. People were so accustomed to doing whatever Augustus and Tiberius said that Caligula had no difficulty in taking over complete control. But before he'd been emperor very long, he seemed to go out of his head. Some have suggested he was poisoned. Others have suggested that certain bad traits in his character came to the fore when he was free from all restraint. What the truth is on this, we don't know. But the fact is that Caligula, instead of doing like the previous emperors did and always appointing two outstanding Romans to be the consuls who were nominally the heads of the Roman government, they had different consuls every year. It had two consuls who were the rulers of Rome, had been for at least 200 or 300 years at this time. And now the emperors always appointed consuls, and sometimes they would appoint themselves. One time he appointed his horse as one of the two consuls. And then Caligula, one thing that Augustus had introduced in order to try to establish, to maintain unity in the empire and to keep loyalty of all to the unified organization, was to have the emperor be considered as a god. And when the emperor died, the Senate would vote to enroll his name among the gods and recognize that he was now a god on Mount Olympus. And so Augustus had had them offer sacrifice to Julius Caesar, and Tiberius had them do it to Augustus. Now Caligula was happy to have them offer sacrifice to Tiberius as a god, his predecessor, but he decided, why wait till death? And so he demanded they worship him as a god. And he ordered statues of himself put up in the temple. And he would go into the temple of Jupiter and talk to Jupiter as if he were another god, along with Jupiter, the leading god of the Romans. Now there is an incident that occurred at this time which does not enter directly into Christian history, but yet which is of great interest in the history of Judaism. And that is that Caligula ordered that a great statue of himself be placed in the temple at Jerusalem, and that the Jews worship it. And this colossal statue of Caligula was brought to carried by sea to Palestine, and there landed, and the Romans started to carry it up to Jerusalem. And the Jews, terribly upset about such a profanation of the temple as putting a statue of a man in it for people to worship as a god, great numbers of Jews lay down on the road where they were to bring the statue, so that the only way they could carry it would be to trample over them, ready to give their lives rather than permit that this statue be carried up and placed in the temple at Jerusalem. And the Roman officers, who were kindly men and had no desire to injure these Jews, but yet who were themselves subject to the emperor and could be killed if they disobeyed orders, were in a quandary what to do. They went slowly and tried to move the Jews out of the way, and finding that if they moved one out, two more would lie down in his place, and finding it very difficult, they sent back to Rome. They stopped and sent to Rome asking for further instructions as exactly how to carry out the orders. And before the instructions could come back, Caligula had been killed, so that this came to an end. But there are some who find the references in Daniel to the one who, sitting in the temple of God, claims to be God and asks that he be worshipped, who think that this points to Caligula's attempt then. It, at any rate, is something that should be taken into consideration in our interpretation of the prophecies of Daniel and the statements in the New Testament of this type. Yes? I didn't give this precise reference, or have the exact reference in mind. But Caligula is thus of interest in connection with Bible study and Bible interpretation more than with church history, because at this time the Christian church was such a small group that Caligula probably was not even aware of its existence. But Caligula was assassinated in 41 A.D. The people as a whole were getting more and more disgusted, and probably there would have been an uprising against him in a few years, but the soldiers, the Praetorian Guard, who guarded the emperor, found him acting in very arbitrary ways towards them, and an insurrection came among them, and he was assassinated there by some of the soldiers who were supposed to guard the emperor. And when they assassinated Caligula, and they were rushing through the palace, trying to establish themselves in control before a force would rise up to destroy them, they came upon a relative of Caligula's who had been generally considered as a poor relation and sort of a rather half-witted fellow. People thought of him, that is, not that he was deficient, nobody thought he amounted to anything much. He was just a member of the royal family that nobody paid much attention to. And he was hiding behind a bed, hearing this uprising, this tumult going on, hiding there for fear of his life. And one of the soldiers grabbed him and lifted him up and said, "Here's the emperor, here's the emperor." And the others, some of them thinking it was a good joke, said, "Yeah, this man's a new emperor." And then others, hearing it, not realizing it was a joke, joined in. And so Claudius became emperor, and he reigned from 41 to 54. And to everyone's surprise, he proved to be a very good emperor. He did not have enough ability or leadership, and never had been an outstanding man in such a way as to give him the feeling that now he was supreme and he could establish what he felt inclined to do. And consequently, he simply fit into the position and did his best to handle it on the whole in a good way. And probably there were good officers who Tiberius had put into power who gave him good advice, and in general he followed their advice, occasionally having to decide between two of them. But for 13 years, Claudius was a very satisfactory emperor and kept the Roman Empire giving peace and security and in general good government to that whole area of most of Europe and a substantial portion of the Near East. Now, Claudius is mentioned in the New Testament. We find him mentioned in Acts 18, where we find the statement made, Acts 18, "After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. Now, there's that reference in the New Testament to the Emperor Claudius. And why did Claudius command that all Jews should depart from Rome? It is indeed a strange statement. We know very, very little about it. But we do have a statement written by a Roman historian many decades later, in which he refers to the fact that the Jews in Rome, stirred up by Crestus, became tumultuous, and Claudius gave order they should all be expelled from Rome. Now that is a very strange statement. Certainly Christ was not in Rome in the time of Claudius. And we do not think that there was a substantial group of Christians there that early. We find here that Aquila and Priscilla came from Rome, having left Rome because they'd been ordered to leave, and that Paul met them here and told them about Christ. It doesn't sound as if they were leaders of Christianity in Rome as early as that. And that's all we know about it. It's just that brief statement in the Roman historian's writings of more than half a century later. And so historians usually consider that it must be that there was a small group of Christians in Rome at this time, and that there had been some hard feeling between them and some other Jews, and that there had been a turmoil which the Romans didn't know the reason of, but that Claudius had simply said, put them all out of Rome, and that thus the order had been given. Now, the order wasn't enforced very long, because we find substantial numbers of Jews in Rome very soon after that time. So it must have been an order that was given and enforced to some extent for a brief period. But the use of that name, some historians write it Crestus and some Christus, but it's rather hard to think where it could have come from if it doesn't have some relation to the name Christ. And so this is perhaps one of our earliest evidences of the spread of Christianity reaching as far as Rome, but it tells us practically nothing about it. But it's interesting how that one statement in this Roman historian ties up with this statement here in the book of Acts about Claudius having expelled the Jews from Rome. Yes? Yes, Suetonius. Suetonius. We'll be saying a good bit more about him in a few minutes. Suetonius. I was going to mention non-Christian sources a little further on, and I'll say a little more about him now. Yes? No, this is the book of Acts.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean... No, I don't think so. The Jews were not expelled for very long from Rome. We don't know how fully it was carried out anyway. We don't know much about it, but it's an interesting thing to bring into relationship to consideration, the date of Rome. But it's not sufficient to really establish much on. Now, Claudius had a... Claudius's wife had been married to someone else before, and she had a son. And she gained quite a control over Claudius, and she managed to get her son made emperor on Claudius's death in 54. And this son was named Nero. And so Nero was emperor from 54 to 68. Here's a period of 14 years. We hear the name of Nero is famous or infamous. Probably the best known of any of these emperors, unless it be Augustus, but known for his wickedness and his folly. I don't think that probably his character in these regards showed itself in the beginning of his reign. If he'd been anywhere near as bad in the first 10 years as he was in the last four, he probably would not have lasted 14 years. He was eventually assassinated, as Caligula had been. But Caligula had only lasted 4 years, Nero lasted 14. And as a young fellow, he may have been a rather attractive and pleasant young fellow who made people think that things were really going to be fine under his direction. And he may have carried on the government rather a normal, good fashion for a time. In the course of 14 years, he had a good many political decisions to make, and some of them seem to have been well made. But as Nero became older, his power went to his head, and his natural cruelty came out, and some advisors whom he had proved to be very bad advisors, and in the end, he gained a terrible name for a brutal tyrant, and so bad that when he was killed, it was the end of the whole dynasty. They no longer thought that they had the Caligula's time of getting a relative and making him emperor in his place. But Nero fancied himself as a poet and as a musician. And he used to go about from city to city through the empire putting on exhibits of his musical talents and reading his poetry. And if people wanted to survive, it was good to clap and cheer. And Nero is said to have had great designs about rebuilding and improving Rome. The city had developed just by accident, like most capital cities have. It gradually grew from a little town into a larger and larger place, and as it became wealthy and prosperous, great numbers of people would crowd into the center while people would be building fine houses on the edge. And then as these houses would deteriorate, they would become slums, and the newer rich people would build a little further out. And Nero thought it would be a wonderful thing to tear down these rotten old four-story houses that were filled with great multitudes of people in so much of Rome, and to build some great, beautiful, modern buildings in their place. And he talked about these ideas. Well, whether he actually decided to destroy the part of Rome, to set a fire to do this, or whether a fire broke out accidentally is something that nobody can possibly prove today. But he had talked that way, at least before the fire started. And that led people to suspect that he had something to do with the burning of a large portion of Rome. And in this fire, there were many people who perished, and there was a great deal of loss, and of course, a great many very old houses were demolished and torn down by the fire and by the later necessary reconstruction. And then they heard about his plans to build a great modern city here, and people who had suffered greatly through the fire began to say that this fire had been set by Nero's agents in order to destroy and to rebuild the city. And we can't prove now whether it was true or not. But a story began to go around that Nero, who was fancied himself as a poet and loved to read dramatic writings from the Greek and Roman writers and to play the violin along with them, that he, as he saw the fire sweeping through the city, that he was moved with the drama of it all, and that he had taken out his violin and begun to play and sing dramatic things as the fire surged through the city. And, of course, nobody can prove today whether Nero actually did that or not, but it has become a proverbial thing about his playing while Rome burned. And, at any rate, soon after this, it began to be said that the fire had been set by a group of people who were called Christians. And these people were, many of them, seized and tortured. And they began to give the most cruel tortures to these people. And this diverted the attention of the people who were so upset about Nero, thinking Nero had been responsible for it. Now, this is the first persecution of Christians of which we have any record. And that is by the Roman Empire. Of course, those Jews who were against them had aroused persecution, as we find in the book of Acts. But this persecution under Nero was the first of the persecutions by the Roman Empire, and it has an importance far beyond the actual persecution itself, in that it seems to have established the general attitude that Christianity was something that was contrary to the Roman Empire. Very often, attitudes like this become established in governments and carry on for a long time. Now, of course, our information on it is comparatively slight. But the name of Nero is important to us in our history because of his relation to Christianity in this way. And when Nero was assassinated in 68, during the next year and a half, we have three emperors, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. I'm not going to give you their names because they only reigned for a few months each. They were generals who seized the power and tried to reign, and the second one came and overcame the first. And for a year and a half, this went on until a general who was fighting against the Jews in Palestine came back from Palestine and established himself in power and established an entirely new dynasty. This was Vespasian in 69. And so we call this the Julian line of emperors thus far, and then the Flavian line was from 69 to 96. And Vespasian ruled for 10 years. He was an able general and an effective administrator and carried on the government much as it had been done by Augustus and Tiberius. He reigned for 10 years and then was succeeded by his son Titus in 79. Now, when he left Palestine, where he had been for 4 years fighting against the Jewish uprising, to come back to Rome and establish himself as emperor, he left his son Titus as commander of the army. And when Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, Titus brought back from the spoils from Jerusalem, and they gave him a triumphal march in Rome. And they put up a column, they put up an arch in honor of Titus, which is standing there to this day. The arch has only one span in the middle of it, contrary to most of them, which have two or three. This has one span in the middle of it, the arch with pictures on it in bas-relief, and they show the spoils of the Jerusalem temple. And many a picture that you will see today of the Colosseum in Rome shows it looking through the Arch of Titus, which is just a short distance from it. And so this Arch of Titus remains to this day as a reminder of the Roman conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But Titus was emperor 2 years, from 79 to 81, only 2 years before he died. He's said to have been a very fine man, very kindly man. Everything we read about Titus speaks very well of him. But he only reigned for 2 years, and then was succeeded by his brother Domitian, D-O-M-I-T-I-A-N, Domitian. D-O-M-I-T-I-A-N. And Domitian reigned from 81 to 96, 15 years. And Domitian may have been jealous of Titus. At any rate, he was a rather jealous and sour disposition and not popular as his brother had been at all. And under him came what is considered to have been the second persecution of the Christians, though we know less about it than we know of Nero's persecution. And Domitian, after Domitian's death in 96, there begins that wonderful period of the Antonines, of which I've already told you, which ran for a century, from 96 to 193. And we'll look at that again in connection with the second century. But now we're looking at the first century, and this is the political background of it. Then we will call capital B, the beginnings of the church. The beginnings of the church. Well, now, properly speaking, the beginnings of the church should be studied under church history. But since our only information about it comes from the Bible, we study it under apostolic history rather than church history. So I only refer to it at this point. Capital B, the beginnings of the church. Our evidence for it is entirely found in the Acts and the Epistles. We have no other evidence as to the beginning of the church. We have no other writings from that time that tells us anything about it. And number two, or under this theme, number one, evidence in Acts and the epistles, and small two, importance of the resurrection. This cannot be overlooked, the importance of the resurrection. Here was not a great conqueror who spread his ideas widely. Here was a man who was crucified, and his disciples scattered, and feeling that everything was ended. And yet, a few days later, we find them going out and boldly proclaiming their belief in him, and eventually leading more and more to believe, until eventually the whole Roman Empire became filled with the knowledge of this one who had been crucified. What made the change in the apostles? It is impossible to account for it except on the idea that the resurrection of Christ occurred, and these men were so thoroughly convinced of it that they were ready to die for their faith in the one who had been crucified and raised from the dead. About 1929, there was a book published, Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone? And this book, I find, is still being distributed to quite an extent in England and over here, 40 years later. The book contained is one of the many that have presented the evidences for the resurrection, which some have called the best authenticated fact in history. It is the foundation of Christianity, certainly the foundation of the spread of the Christian religion, is the resurrection of Christ. A friend of mine told me just last week how he was interested to learn something more about Frank Morrison, and wrote to the publishers, and they told him that it was a pseudonym, but they didn't know anything more about it. And he said he wrote to the Library of Congress, and they told him who it actually was, a man in Scotland. They gave him the name of the man, but he didn't remember the name to tell me who had written under this pseudonym. But he said the book was still being distributed. He thought it was a remarkably excellent treatment of this subject. So there have been many other treatments of it. But it is a subject which every Christian should become well familiar with, because it is a factual evidence of the truth of Christianity, that the resurrection of Christ did actually occur. I was at a meeting about 3 years ago at which the editor of the magazine Christianity Today spoke, and he said that he had been at a meeting shortly before in Washington, D.C., at which Karl Barth, the famous modern theologian, spoke at the dinner, and where there were representatives of many papers, particularly religious papers, and then they had discussion and questions. And he said after various ones raised questions, he got up and he gave his name, and then the name of the magazine, Christianity Today, and then he said, Professor Barth, he said, if somebody could have stood with a modern television camera facing the tomb where Christ was buried on the morning of the resurrection day, he said, would he have been able to get pictures of something definitely happening there? And he said, Bart's face got red, he got very angry. He said, you say you're from Christianity Today, you ought to call it Christianity Yesterday. And that was his only answer to it, was to brush it aside as myth and legend. But the fact is that scholars have been, who have investigated, have most of them been convinced that this is something which the evidence of which is very, very solid and very strong, that something actually did happen there, that the tomb was opened, that Jesus Christ came out, that the resurrection actually occurred. And that is the foundation of the Christian church. Now that, of course, belongs under apostolic history and under apologetics rather than under church history, but all church history proceeds from that. And therefore, we must take these few minutes to stress it at this point, and then go on to capital C, the period of little evidence. The period of little evidence. And this is a point which I think we ought to know about, but which is not realized as it should be among Christians. The period of little evidence. You often hear people say, well, what did the early church do? What do we find in the first century or the second century A.D.? We should fashion our churches like the early church. Well, God in his providence ruled that we should know nothing about the early church. except what we find in the New Testament. The question is not what did the early church do, the question is what does the Bible teach? What does God's Word teach? And all that we know about the early church, that is the church of the first century, I would say that 99% of all we know about it, perhaps 100% of all we know for certain about it, we learn from the New Testament. And of course, the book of Acts and the epistles, and even in the book of Revelation, there is a certain amount of historical material, even though in the main it's looking forward rather than looking to the immediate situation. But aside from the New Testament, we know practically nothing about the Christian church during this whole first century. And so under this, capital C, the period of little evidence, number one, how there comes to be so little evidence. How there comes to be so little evidence. And under this, I mentioned three facts. Small a, the type of writing material. At this time, writing material was quite widely used. There was a great deal of writing in the Roman Empire. There were extensive records made and kept. And there were contracts made and records of every sort. Literacy was very widespread at this time. People, for instance, were publishing books. They had no printing press, but a man would have 50 slaves, each of them with papyrus and with pen and ink, and he would read and they would write it down. Thus, he would prepare 50 books at once. There were factories like this, preparing books at that time. But at that time, the writing material was practically all papyrus. And papyrus is not a great deal better than the paper that we use today. If you take a couple of newspapers and put them in your attic and leave them there for a few years, go back and look at them, they'll probably just disintegrate when you touch them. Because our newspapers are on very, very poor paper. But even fairly good paper of today does not last many centuries. And papyrus, it was a little better than our present, most of our present writing papers. There are some things published today on very fine, expensive rag paper to last much longer. But within the next three or four centuries, they developed means of taking skins of animals and cutting off. Cutting thin sheets and writing on these. And these would last. They were like leather, only far thinner than any leather we ever have, but they would last for many, many centuries. But they did not use it except for extremely important things and extremely wealthy people or great political officials. Did not use this in the first century AD. So we have much more preserved from the 3rd century A.D. than from the 1st century A.D. of every sort of thing. And one reason for it is the comparatively poor writing material that they used mainly at that time. And then small b is the lack of stimulus to write history. The lack of stimulus to write history. The early Christians during this century were constantly on the move. They were, many of them, having a hard time earning their living. Many of those of them who were giving their full time to spreading the gospel were often in danger, having to move from place to place. They had comparatively little time to think of writing history, and they were much interested in reaching all they could, people they could, for the Lord. And someone may say, isn't that strange? The Christian church didn't stop and write a history of itself. I believe the first history of the Christian church that we have was written about 320 A.D., after Constantine had established the church in the Roman Empire. Then Eusebius wrote his great history. But what did he know about events 300 years earlier? He had to go by what records he could find, and these were very limited. There was not much stimulus to write history. Well, you say, why didn't people get busy and write the history then? Well, anyone who says that, I'll say to you, why didn't somebody write a history of your ancestors? Tell me about your ancestors 300 years ago. Where did they live? What did they do? What were their names? It would be unusual if anybody in this class could give the names of as many as 10 of his ancestors who lived in the 3rd century back from now. And the chances are everybody here had 100 ancestors who lived during that century. But we just don't keep those records. Even in our own lives, we have very important things happen to most of us. And then we think back of it 30 years later, and we can't remember within 3 or 4 years of when it happened. And how much of it do we tell our children? The history of individual families disappeared. And the early Christians, during this first 3 centuries, had little stimulus to write history. But then historians recognize a third fact. Small c. The expectation of the return of Christ. And of the soon return of Christ. And most church histories will mention that the early Christians did not bother much with writing history. They did not bother with trying to remember where particular events in the life of Christ had occurred. Or matters like that, because they were so convinced that very, very soon Jesus Christ would come back to this earth and set up his great kingdom of righteousness and happiness upon this earth. They were busy trying to reach as many as possible with the gospel. And their whole attitude was looking forward rather than looking back to these great events. And so the place of the crucifixion, the place of the tomb, the place of the events of Christ's life, it's amazing in a way how little attention was paid to trying to remember where these things happened in that time. But when we think that people were looking forward instead of back, and during the first 2 centuries, practically all Christians were looking forward, expecting, as Paul said, we which remain will not delay those who are dead when Christ comes back. We who remain alive to his coming. It was the expectation of most everyone that Christ would come within their lifetime during these first few centuries, as practically all church historians recognize. That's number one, then, how there comes to be so little evidence. Then number two, why God allowed such a gap in our knowledge. And God works all things together for good to them that love him, and anything as important as this does not come about by accident. God oversaw it. God determined it should be this way. And there are many truths in the history of the church of which we know a great deal. But during the first century, aside from what's in the New Testament, we know practically nothing about the Christian church. We have practically no other source of knowledge about the Christian church during this long period. And it must be that God intentionally allows that it should be so. And I think we should recognize the fact that God wants our emphasis to be not on what early Christians thought, not on what early Christians did, but on what God says in his revelation, what the Bible teaches. That is our sole and only foundation for Christian life and Christian activity. And God allowed this gap in our knowledge, a sizable gap, which is largest during the first century, but still during much of the second century, our knowledge is quite incomplete. If you get a fairly extensive history of the Pope written by a Roman Catholic, you get an official Roman Catholic history of the Pope, you will find that if they will list what they call the successors of Peter as bishops of Rome or popes in the first century, and they will give you 2 names, and they will say whether these are 2 different persons or the same person, nobody knows. And that just shows how great our ignorance is of this church. That with their claims for the importance of the Bishop of Rome, they will recognize that we don't know for certain whether Cletus and Anacletus were 2 different men or whether they are the same man who was the head of the church at Rome during this period. Just shows how little we know about Christianity during this century except what is in the Bible, which is our one dependable source of knowledge. Number three, traditions about the apostles. There are a few traditions about the apostles, but not about very many of them from this early church. There is a tradition that Paul went to Asia Minor, that he lived in Ephesus, and that he died there, and that John lived to be longer than any of the others. There is a tradition that Peter and Paul were both of them killed in Nero's persecution in Rome. There's a tradition. There's no proof of it. There's no statement from that time, no statement until a good many decades later about it by anybody. But there are traditions that grew up largely a century or 2 centuries later about the apostles. There is practically nothing that we know with certainty about the apostles except what is contained in the New Testament. But we do have a few of these traditions. And then you get on a good many centuries later, and you find people writing imaginary stories about certain of the apostles and where they went and what they did and the miracles they wrought and all kinds of apocryphal stories which were made up many centuries later and which no one pays any attention to as far as any source of historical evidence is concerned. Now, number four is the earliest Christian writing, that's not the title. Number four will be the earliest Christian writing of which we can date with any certainty. This we call First Clement. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes. There is an early tradition that Thomas went to India. I think we can say that as early as the 6th century AD, it was believed that Thomas went to India. But as far as I know, there's no evidence earlier than that. It may be entirely true, but you just can't prove it. But number four, then, is First Clement. First Clement. And this is the earliest non-biblical writing that can be dated with fair certainty. There are two or three other writings which some say are earlier than this and some later. But we can't be sure. But fairly early writings. But this epistle of First Clement is a very interesting work, but unfortunately one which gives us practically no historical knowledge. It does give us knowledge that there was in the Church of Rome a man named Clement. And this is usually dated somewhere between 95 and 100 A.D. So it's just at the very end of the first century. Now this epistle of the first epistle of Clement, they call it. There is a second epistle of Clement, which is generally considered as not to be by Clement, generally considered to be a later writer. But the first epistle of Clement is generally recognized, accepted as having been written by a man named Clement, who was in the church at Rome, and who writes to the church in Corinth, exhorting the church in Corinth to be true to the Lord, and to do away with their divisions and their animosities, and to stand loyally to the truth of God. It's very similar to 1 and 2 Corinthians, and has many phrases that are taken over bodily from 1 and 2 Corinthians. It is filled with the phraseology of various New Testament books. According to Roman tradition, Clement was the bishop of Rome at this time, according to Roman Catholic tradition. He was bishop of Rome at this time. But he does not call himself bishop in the letter. He makes no claim to any special authority as bishop in the letter. But it's interesting that he writes on behalf of the Church of Rome to the Church in Corinth, and he uses a tone which you would expect the church in the great capital city maybe to use toward a church in a secondary city. There's a sort of a condescension toward the Corinthians as he urges them to be better in their manners and in their loyalty to Christ. It's an interesting letter. Doubtless he was a real Christian, but it doesn't give us any knowledge of history of the time. That's number four, and that's the only writing that we can speak with any great certainty of having been written before 100 A.D. There's the so-called Epistle of Barnabas, which Barnabas certainly didn't write, and is dated anywhere between 70 A.D. and 130 A.D. We can't be sure within 60 years when it was written. And there are a few other early writings like that that we can't be sure within many years when they were written. This First Clement is the only writing we can be fairly sure comes from the first century, except the New Testament, and it is very early. So we cannot find from Christian sources much evidence as to the history of Christianity during the first century A.D. Practically none, except for the great amount of information we have in the book of Acts about the early years of the Christian church. And that's why I gave you this study of the book of Acts, which is so important as a basis for all study of church history, though it really falls more in the field of apostolic history than of church history. And our earliest Christian history, as I mentioned, is the history of Eusebius, about 320 A.D., that's 300 years later. And he tells us quite a number of things about the first century, and we don't know whether he had any sources, any valid source for them or not. Some of the things he says, most people think are truth. Some of the things he says, most people think were purely tradition that sprung up with no basis for. But then number five, information from non-Christian sources. Now we have one thing from a non-Christian source which sheds a little light on early Christian Christianity from the first century, but not very much. That is small A. Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish general who led in the uprising in northern Palestine against the Romans in 66 A.D. He led the Jews against the Romans. He was captured by Vespasian. And when they were about to put him to death, he loudly proclaimed a prophecy that Vespasian would become emperor of Rome. And this pleased Vespasian. He thought the man must have something to him that would make a nice prophecy like that. And they did not kill Josephus, but he became a friend of Titus. And he was with Titus among the Roman forces when Jerusalem was taken. And then Titus took him with him to Rome and gave him things they had taken from the looting of Palestine and enabled him to live in good style in Rome. And he lived there until just about the end of the century. And Josephus wrote a number of works. And in Josephus' history of the Jewish war, he does mention the Christ who performed miracles and was raised from the dead and so on. And since Josephus was not a Christian, but was a Jew and wrote in defense of the Jews, this has been usually considered until recently as an interpolation put into Josephus' work by some Christian in the Middle Ages, putting him in the right place, an account of Christ and of the origin of Christianity. However, Professor von Harnack in Berlin, who was considered one of our greatest scholars of church history, advanced evidence which he thought showed that Josephus had actually written it. But in order to take it that way, he would interpret this meaning, not that Christ did miracles and that he was raised from the dead, but that he is the one whom his people believed had done these things. And that Josephus actually wrote. Because if Josephus really believed Jesus was raised from the dead and would write that in a book that was distributed, you certainly would expect him to become a Christian. And Harnack thinks that Josephus refers to this movement that was growing to its source, to where it happened and what its followers believed. Well, there has been, as they say, up till 40 years ago, practically all scholars said it's an interpolation. Josephus has one or two statements about the history of Palestine in the early days of Christianity, which touch upon events we mentioned in the New Testament. And so he has some interest in that connection, in connection with biblical statements. But aside from this, and he gives us practically no information about early Christianity. But we do have three Roman writers from whom we have a very little information about Christian history. They wrote about 130, 120, 130 A.D., but they described events 60 years earlier, and they doubtless had some pretty good sources for their information. We'll look at them tomorrow.